Well, thank you so much for inviting me this evening. What a wonderful venue and time we had out there chatting for a little while. But now it's time to get down to business. I get to talk about one of my most passionate ideological principles, and that's sustainability. What I want to do tonight is to first set the stage for what the problem we are facing, and then I'll offer some ideas of how to solve that problem, looking at making cities more sustainable. So maybe the title is a little obscure, Gigaton. Well, just in case you don't know, a giga is a billion. So the title of my presentation will be Gigaton Problems Require Gigaton Solutions, and really looking at the opportunities in systems, in urban systems, for solving the gigaton problem. But first we'll start out with, what is the gigaton problem? First thing we got to recognize is the demand side of sustainability. And over here we have the earth. It provides the resources. Those resources flow here. We have demand of the of these services and goods. And then we can't quite convert everything that we bring into the system into goods and services. We generate waste. And there's one thing that maybe many of us don't really understand, and that is we may have to control sometime in the future our expectations. How many resources can we command and live sustainably in this world? We might talk about new technologies, maybe hybrid vehicles. So how many hybrid vehicles can the Earth sustain? 1 billion? 2? 4? 8? There's going to be a limit. Maybe vehicles aren't going to be in the future. We're going to have to design our communities in such a way that they're more compact. We don't have to drive. That might be the direction we have to head. So there's something we really have to recognize, and that's what I call the demand side of sustainability. How many of these things that we produce can the world sustain in terms of providing resources and in terms of assimilating the waste that are generated? I tried to write this down in a simple way here. We need to recreate the anthroposphere, that's the place that we live, to exist within the means of nature, and that has two simple criteria. One, we have to have renewable resources. We have to use renewable resources in commerce in the long term. And two, we can't overwhelm natural cycles with the wastes and our interference with the cycles. So really, this is going to expand our domain of engineering. We heard a little conversation a little while ago about how we have to think about policy and all those other important things. We have to really examine the interactions between natural, social, and economic systems. So this is going to expand the realm of trying to provide solutions, sustainable solutions, especially as myself and as an engineer, we have to start embracing these other concepts. Because after all, it's people, two feet at a time in the shopping aisle and the voting booth, that are going to drive this agenda. Okay, so let's start with one of those two hypotheses. And this is the one where we cannot generate waste that nature cannot assimilate without overwhelming the cycles. To really address this appropriately, we'd have to look at the fate of toxics, nitrogen, phosphorus, water, carbon, and lots of other cycles. I'd like to say a few things, though. Let's just take nitrogen. Do you know that two-thirds protein has nitrogen in it? And that two-thirds of the nitrogen in the protein in your body came from the Haber process. We took nitrogen out of the atmosphere and created ammonia fertilizers, nitrogen fertilizers. Eventually, that made their way into animals, and we eventually assimilated those, two-thirds. The crazy thing is now that becomes a waste, and in our wastewater, it takes almost as much energy to get out. Imagine trying to fix nitrogen out of the atmosphere to create a fertilizer in the first place. Phosphorus. We might only have about 100 years of mineable phosphorus left. When we run out, we run out. We're going to go to the ocean and filter the ocean to get the phosphorus we need. So that points to this idea of trying to close the loop, a circular economy. Well, anyway, I'd like to focus a little bit on carbon. Carbon is something we've been focusing on a lot with regard to climate change and the like. Okay, so this is the IEA, International Energy Administration's forecast for the future for three different scenarios. Here's where we are right now. This is gigatons of carbon, around 9 gigatons of carbon. And this is the scenario for 2 degrees rise in the Earth's temperature average. This is the number that we have to hit for 4, and this is the number we have to hit for 6. And most scientists think that this is probably the direction that we should head. That's for the 2 degrees Celsius rise. And we certainly don't want to go to the 6 degrees Celsius rise. This is a famous plot by McKinsey that talks about the economics of all the strategies we might use for achieving that carbon goal. And what we are looking at here is the cost, and if it's a negative cost, that means it's got a payback, in euros per ton of a CO2 equivalent. And from zero to over here is 10.3 gigatons of carbon. So you can see all of these things down here actually don't cost anything at all. In fact, we get a return on these things like LED lighting, motor systems efficiency, cropland nutrient management, electricity from landfill gas, etc. And then over here we start talking about things that actually cost money and so on. So you can take a look at this, and I invite you to look at our website. We'll have these slides posted. You can study this in a little more detail. So we're sort of failing on carbon. It's going to increase. It's been increasing, and we need to do something on a scale that solves the gigaton problem. Okay, so the next one is renewable resources. We have to use resources that nature provides. Of the 70 gigatons of material, 70 billion tons of material that we use in the yearly world economy, only 29% is renewable, assuming that biomass is totally renewable. That's not sustainable in the long term. Let's have a look at some of the use, just because it might be interesting. This is the annual world production in tons per year. Over here, and then this is the magic gigaton line that I keep talking about. See, oil and coal is way above that. Steel is pretty close. Aluminum, copper, all the way down to gold. So those are the metals. For thermoplastics, you can see here polyethylene, PVC, polypropylene, and PET. And then ceramics, concrete, asphalt, glass, brick, and so on. And fibrids and hybrids, like natural fibers. Woods are arguably a renewable resource. And I've added the gigawatts that are of energy that are required. The energy required for the top 7 materials is about 1.5 terawatts, or about 10% of the primary energy that we use in the economy today. And guess what, folks? it turns out that the big 5, thermoplastics, concrete, aluminum, steel, the demand is going to go up 50% in the next 30 to 50 years, and we're not going to be able to make that CO2 target, even with the best projections of renewable energy implementation, because of that increased demand. So here's the gigaton problem all in one slide. We have 1 billion people. Here's 70 billion metric tons. That is the material that we use in the world economy, only 29% is renewable. Energy use in tons of oil equivalent, 12 billion. Only 20% is nuclear and renewable, so arguably you might say that might have no carbon impact. Carbon from fossil fuels, we already mentioned this, 9 billion tons. Water use, 120 billion cubic meters used every year. And here we have 1 billion cars. This is not sustainable in the long term. I'd also like to mention, from an egalitarian point of view, that at some point, maybe in 2050, we're going to be 9 billion people. So this problem that I've talked about, the gigaton problem, was created by the Golden Billion. Maybe many of us in this room, we could consider the Golden Billion. And from an egalitarian point of view, everyone's going to want to have the same kind of lifestyle that we have. And so we might have to multiply this by a factor of 9 or 10 to think about what the resource utilization would be and the waste generation would be that we'd have to think about in the long term. In order to create a world in which it's safe, secure, and everyone has leading useful and productive lives, that's going to be an important goal for us to achieve when it comes to sustainability. Many people ask me this question, so I'm going to answer it right now. What about controlling the population? Well, I don't want to say it controlling, that sounds too much, but managing population. This graph here is interesting. This shows the children per woman as a function of the childhood survivability rate. And what you'll notice here is that when you have a much higher childhood survivability, around 90% or so, the number turns out to be about 2.3, which is a replacement amount. Think of it this way. When you're talking about lower childhood mortality, what's going to happen is we're going to see more children being born and more of them reaching adulthood, so we're going to see a higher, a larger population. Remember, to die young in Burundi means to die when you're one. To die young when you're in Sweden means you die when you're 63. This is a solvable problem in some respects. I mean, many of the problems that we see where this is occurring is in failed states. We can't do anything about that. We have to have a government that's functioning. Okay. But the rest of it, the sanitation piece, providing clean drinking water, we know how to do that. So if we could push everyone over here, we might be able to control the amount of, or manage the number of people that we see in the future. Okay, so I just want to put myself out there on this scale. On one side, you might say I'm a pessimist. On the other side, an optimist. I'll put myself in the middle, like Hans Rosling, a pragmatic possibilist. So we'll talk about what might be possible. And so here I have some thoughts on solving the gigaton problem that relates to cities, high-performance buildings, efficient electric power generation, electrification of transportation, enhancing ecosystem services or avoiding their destruction. And there's a lot of other issues here. Market drivers for energy efficiency. I'm a market guy. I really believe in the market. The market can do magical things. We put signals out there for General Electric and all the other folks to respond to. They're going to do it. I'm going to go right to the bottom here. Really devise a market or stipulate mandates that really get the giga inventors, the investors and entrepreneurs on task. We have some of the best universities in the world, like McGill. Lots of clever students. We have some of the best national labs in this North America. And we have lots of investors and entrepreneurs. We just got to give them the task and get on task. Let's get this ball rolling and develop a market economy that's more sustainable. Okay. That's interesting. Changed the color of my slides. Well, anyway, so now I want to talk briefly about cities. And one of the topics I wanted to bring up was this topic of infrastructure ecology. I want to give you a feeling for what that is. Basically, in the past, we've designed our urban infrastructure to be in a stovepipe manner. I focus on water, and I do that as best I can. Or energy generation distribution, I do that as best I can. Planning, transportation, etc. But if we look at this as a whole, a system as a whole, we can reduce the amount of resources that are used by the city. Think of a city as an ecosystem, as an ecosystem of interactions between people and infrastructure. And what happens is that resources flow into this ecosystem, waste flow out of that ecosystem, and inside the ecosystem what we're trying to do is create infrastructure that creates comfort and wealth. And the whole objective is to reduce the investment of resources, reduce the amount of waste that are generated, and increase the amount of infrastructure that creates comfort and wealth. That's the general idea. Well, I believe that using this concept of infrastructure ecology, we can get there. Okay, so here are some fundamental questions. Boy, this has changed my slides completely. Anyway, so how are energy and materials information and water utilized by different configurations of populations? And how do we look at these communities of infrastructure? How do they emerge from cultural, physical, and economic conditions of a region? So I thought I'd give you a little example so you can get your mind around this a little bit. This is what is the carbon metabolism of FATE in Toronto. And over here we have the input and the local extraction of carbon. And then we have various sectors, ag, industry and commerce, construction, transportation, and domestic use. So these flows of carbon go through there and then eventually end up as emissions or waste, or they get assimilated into something, exported, recycled, or end up as stock gains within the city. So this kind of analysis will help you try to understand where all the carbon is going, what are the demands for the carbon, how might you better control it, et cetera. So I want to say some more about the interconnections between urban infrastructure. I've mentioned that there is interactions, but I want to quantify that a little bit. On average, we in the United States, we use about 2 gallons of water per every kilowatt hour of energy that's generated. The other way around, energy for water, about 4% of the U.S. electrical energy is used for water and wastewater sector, 19% in California. Most of that is conveyance, moving that water around. Energy for transportation, about 28% of the total energy consumption in the U.S. is for transportation. Now, the connection between transportation and land use, empirical studies show that if you build one new highway through the city, it reduces the central city population by 18%. That's not a good thing. Now people are going to be driving in and out and back and forth. That's going to use more carbon. And the use of rainwater harvesting could reduce, in Southern California, a lot of other places, a significant amount of electrical energy. Some other connections. There's been quite a bit of discussion about biofuels. In fact, we have this this biofuels implementation initiative in the United States. It's like 22 billion gallons of biofuels used by 2020. Well, the water footprint, we've got to think about the water footprint. This could use, besides the food, if it competes with food, the water footprint of biofuels could be 100 to 10 to 1,000 times higher than for conventional gasoline. Electrification of personal transportation. Now, it's been shown that if we use electricity to power our vehicles, that will significantly reduce the carbon footprint of our transportation. However, we currently use water and we evaporate water to reject heat at our power plants. So the direct consequence of that would be increased amount of water use. In the city of Atlanta, we estimate that the amount of water that would be required would be almost equal to the domestic demand, 100 million gallons per day, if we electrified the entire fleet in Atlanta. Back to Canada for a moment. Maybe I'll recognize the Olympic Village there in Vancouver. What they're doing is actually mining heat from the sewer, and 70% of the annual energy demand can be met by mining heat from the sewer. It's changed my slides. I had the name of it up there. But anyway, so this 1,800 residences are located in here, and it'll reduce the greenhouse gas emissions by 50%. Another thing that's gaining favor is potential of, with the electric vehicles, talking about this combination between different infrastructures. If you have your electric vehicle as a battery that can feed to the grid, This shows what it might look like when we have more renewables, the base load, you know, the load that you would see for a power plant or energy production. It looks like a layer cake. The bottom layer is base load. And then maybe on top of that is PV, you'll notice during the day. And then wind power on top of that, more consistent. And then on top of that we have this, what we call the middle load, which we might have to add by spinning reserves. Anyway, later in the evening here we still have a high demand. It might be that our vehicles, once they're home, could supply energy to this grid. And then also there's a significant amount of variability in some of the production of energy, like photovoltaics. And so what we typically might have to do is keep more spinning reserves in the background to make up for those slight variations. Maybe the vehicle-to-grid idea could help solve that problem. So think of this as a collection of ideas. We have, I already mentioned the connection between PV and vehicle-to-grid. We also have the possibility of having rainwater harvesting. Now we don't have to convey that water to communities because we can get it out of the sky. It's the cleanest form of water we have. Low-impact development, what we're trying to do there is restore the original hydrology of our sites to restore that back to its original state so we don't have as much stormwater runoff, uncontrolled stormwater runoff, which then can go into the sewer and flood that, and that may end up in the surface waters. And then another idea that we've been looking at is air-cooled microturbines. I mentioned that most power plants use water to reject heat. But you could also use air to reject the heat and then use that heat for heating and cooling. I'll talk about that in a minute. So using all these things as a collection, you could reduce water and energy, lower dependence on centralized systems, impose larger share of renewables, and by land use options, put people closer to where they want to be on a day-to-day basis, reduce vehicle miles traveled, and actually increase tax revenue because that green infrastructure adds value, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So here's some of the decentralized water issues. These are for controlling stormwater, bioretention ponds. Here you can see a vegetated swale, bioretention ponds here. Green roof, this is a green roof. We have a rain barrel here for harvesting rainwater and the like. Here's a case study I wanted to mention about the increased tax revenue. There's an effort in Vancouver, another Canadian story here. The name of it I really like. It says, From Pipe Dreams to Healthy Streams. Think of what we've done in the past. What we did is we came in and we scraped off the ecology and we covered it with hard scrape, and now we have a stormwater problem. Okay, now, and then we bring in water in big pipes, and we bring water out in big pipes, including the stormwater. So that's why I like this, From Pipe Dreams to Healthy Streams. That's the title of their project. And what they were looking at is how are they going to deal with this stormwater that then overflows into the surface waters and contaminates them. How can we control that? One option is the big pipe option. The big pipe option is you take it away in a big pipe, put it into a large treatment system, treat it, and it goes into the ocean. Price tag, $4 billion. That sounds like a lot of money. What else could we do? They came upon the idea of having wetlands treat that stormwater, and then the water would leave those wetlands and flow through green belts to salmon-bearing rivers. And along those green belts, the price of real estate would go up. By the way, human health might improve as well, because now I have a place where I can go for a walk, and it looks aesthetically nice. And because of the niceness of that green space, the property values go up, real estate taxes go up, and it was a $400 million benefit. So we took a problem and created an opportunity. So there is this connection between the socioeconomic environment, and it's not negative all the time. Some other things here, I guess I should skip over these. This is a special kind of toilet that can separate urine from feces. The reason you do that is you could recover some of the nitrogen and phosphorus I was talking about earlier. Energy recovery from wastewater, low fixture toilets, other things. So I got to move on. Okay, so I wanted to tell you about one more technology you might find interesting, and it's called combined heat and power. This is used in Europe, mainly Scandinavian countries, Helsinki and Denmark and the like. But basically, the way we normally do power generation in the United States is we have a central power plant. In this central power plant, 100 units of energy go in, we lose some right away, we just reject that heat, evaporate water. We lose some on the grid, so by the time it comes here to the plug, we've lost another 6 units, and then useful electrical energy is about 29. But with combined heat and power, we have 100 units of energy in, we lose about 15, we use that heat, rather than evaporating water, we use that heat for heating and cooling and hot water, and then we get about 35 units of energy because this is going to be closer to where we're going to use it. And this is a little picture of a microturbine. This is air-cooled. So on one side, it's a, you might call it a furnace that creates heat as well as it creates electricity. And then that heat can be put through an absorption chiller, and we can then create cooling as well. Let me give you, this is kind of a busy slide, but I'll give you some of the benefits. Suppose we had a neighborhood of 12 single-family homes. One 30-kilowatt microturbine, you could get about 54% of the electrical energy that you need. There would be enough heat coming off that could be also, this is also thermal loading, includes heating and cooling. We'd have more than enough to keep these buildings cool and, or warm, depending on the season. We would save about 54% of the water, and again, we have to make up this electricity from the grid. We're still going to get up 46% of the energy from the grid. So this is this idea of combined heat and power. Why should you throw that heat away? Let's use it. Oh, boy, this really changed my slides. I don't know what happened here. Anyway, we did these projections for Atlanta. I'm just going to quickly go here. This is business as usual, and this is for more sustainable development. And what you'll see here is there's a lot more yellow. Those are the low to medium residential houses. And you can see there's a lot more yellow here than there is here. In fact, this looks pretty much like it did in 2005. Now what we're doing is having more compact living. So we have these two cases, business as usual, more sustainable development. And then we look at different scenarios with the more sustainable development strategies, see how much water we might save. First of all, in terms of energy, and this is energy for electricity as well as energy for thermal. So this is thermal, and this is electrical energy. That's what this is. This is for the more sustainable development strategy, and this is for the businesses as usual. You can have a 25% reduction, not using microturbines as compared to using them. And then in terms of water withdrawal, I want to point out a couple things here. Withdrawal is water coming out, and then evaporative is what's totally lost. You can see the numbers here for Atlanta. It's about 5,600 million gallons per day. And most of that is for electrical energy. And this little tiny piece up here is the domestic use. And if we put in our combined heat and power with air-cooled, we can reduce the amount of withdrawal by 61%. And we can reduce the amount of evaporation. This is the loss from evaporation. This is electrical. This is electrical energy. And this little piece here is domestic consumption evaporative. We can reduce this by 60%. And this is a huge number. I mean, yes, I want to use low flow fixtures, but it's the number is not hardly a decimal here. Go look from this to that. It's hardly a decimal in the fourth place. But if you could eliminate using water for evaporation to cool for rejection of heat in our centralized power plants, you would have many advantages. Okay, I'm going to return my gigaton. Okay, so we also looked at the carbon emissions, because now we use more of the carbon. It's all coming more from natural gas. We can actually reduce the carbon footprint by 45%, or about 0.04 gigatons of CO2. So that's a huge amount of savings. Okay, so this is a summary of everything here. Urban systems are really all connected, and more efficiency can be achieved by looking at those interactions. Decentralized, those smaller turbines, and combined heat and power can save water and energy, a significant amount of water. This kind of proves the view of a systems view, looking at it from a systems, what are the options? I didn't get a chance to go through all the details on the low-impact development, but I did show you that from the Vancouver case that you could actually have turn a problem into an opportunity. And land use, it goes without saying, is really important for urban systems, trying to make those more compact living space, make all your day-to-day amenities closer by. Maybe you don't even have to drive. And that's what the slide here about our dimensions of inquiry when we're talking about this. Limited or scalable, can we scale this up to a large scale? Disconnected or integrated for more resiliency, is it centralized or decentralized? And so we're at all about this. Technological innovation, fundamental knowledge, workforce development. And then a very important thing is increasing diversity. We already heard comments about how the demographics of our society is changing. We need to have different faces in engineering, as well as change the face of engineering in terms of embracing sustainability. And then looking at more sustainable, resilient cities. And my last slide here. Okay, so we have these two planets that meet in space. We arrange our ideological deck chairs on the Titanic, which was never supposed to sink, right? And then, anyway, so sooner or later, the Earth will have to come into equilibrium. That is, resources generated will equal resources used. And so I have a couple questions. Will humans be part of that new Earth that's in equilibrium? And if they are, will that be a comfortable place or a place wrought with armed conflict and social injustice because of limited resources? So we really have a lot of work to do. We've got to solve this gigaton problem. We've got to redesign our cities in such a way that they use less resources, generate more infrastructure that creates comfort and wealth. So I leave you with that. Thank you for your attention.